Hello, I'm Matt Wells, and this is Media Talk. Coming up,
the British press is having a privacy law imposed on it, which is, I would argue, undermining the ability of mass circulation newspapers to sell newspapers in an ever more difficult market.
Moral outrage, lily-livered liberalism, and a privacy law through the back door. We'll discuss the case for and against the Daily Mail's Paul Dacre after his explosive speech at the Society of Editors conference. Also on this podcast, Dawn Airey cries wolf and Sky One's controller jumps ship to join her at five. What now for the fortunes of both broadcasters? And take one aging lesbian, add a dash of boy band hunk, throw in a kangaroo sphincter and sprinkle liberally with a bit of Esther Ranson. We'll be asking if the lineup for this year's I'm a Celebrity makes for the best bunch of jungle misfits so far. All this and some serious stuff too. It's right here in Media Talk from The Guardian. This week, BT announced it was cutting 10,000 jobs across the company, but our panel is made up of two people who'll hopefully prove it's still good to talk. Emily Bell is The Guardian's Director of Digital Content. We appreciate the effort, but there really wasn't any need for the Maureen Lipman-style purple rinse.
Well, only for you, Matt.
Thank you very much. James Robinson is the media editor of The Observer. Are you feeling loquacious?
Yes, well, I've had half a bottle of wine, so...
Excellent. Good, that's all ready to go.
Sunday newspaper lunch.
Yes, indeed.
On the web, we were working really hard all lunchtime.
I'm doing it while I still can.
Yeah, absolutely. Integration's around the corner. Let's start with a word from someone who's probably never heard this podcast, and if he had, he'd never have approved of the language. We join him as he's just finished talking about a golden era for one of Britain's least loved Sunday papers.
Some of you here tonight, I suspect, may sneer at the kind of family values page or paper I've just described, that almost comic obsession with the letters page. Those values, you'll argue, belong to another era. Well, maybe. My own view is that some values are timeless. And the fact is that at its height, the Sunday Express had a circulation of about 5 million, of whom a staggeringly high percentage were ABC One readers. Today, the Sunday Express barely manages a circulation of 600,000. It is, of course, owned by a pornographer who is contemptuous of journalists and journalism, who's just curtailed the paper's pension scheme, and who's now doing away with sub-editors. It was, I would suggest, one of the great acts of perfidy to our profession, one that speaks volumes for the tawdry values of the Blair Campbell years, that Richard Desmond was judged to meet the legal requirement of being a fit and proper person to own a newspaper.
Oh, I have just come over all moral now, just listening to him. We must resist the temptation to sneer. Actually, it's so good, I think we should hear a bit more.
Can we?
Please.
Whatever our individual newspapers' views are of the Prime Minister, and the Mail is pretty tough on him, we should, as an industry, acknowledge that to date has been a great friend of press freedom. But there is one remaining threat to press freedom that I suspect may prove far more dangerous to our industry. The British press is having a privacy law imposed on it, which, apart from allowing the corrupt and the crooked to sleep easily in their beds, is, I would argue, undermining the ability of mass circulation newspapers to sell newspapers in an ever more difficult market. The law is not coming from Parliament. No, that would smack of democracy. But from the arrogant and amoral judgments of one man. I am referring, of course, to Justice David Eadie, who has again and again, under the Privacy Clause of the Human Rights Act, found against newspapers and their age-old freedom to expose the moral shortcomings of those in high places. Now, recently, of course, the very same Justice Eadie effectively ruled that it's perfectly acceptable for the multi-millionaire head of a multi-billion pound sport that is followed by countless young people to pay five women £2,500 to take part in acts of unimaginable sexual depravity with him. The judge found for Max Mosley because he had not engaged in a sick Nazi orgy, as the News of the World contested. Though for the life of me, that seems an almost surreally pedantic logic. In the Mosley case, the judge is ruling that there is no public interest in revealing a public figure's involvement in acts of depravity. What the judge loftily calls the new rights-based jurisprudence of the Human Rights Act seems to be ruling out any such thing as public standards of morality and decency, and the right of newspapers to report on digressions from those standards.
Well, he sounds like a fun sort of guy, doesn't he? That was disgusted Paul Dacre speaking, the editor-in-chief, of course, of the Daily Mail, speaking earlier this week at the Society of Editors annual conference in Bristol. Emily, you're champing at the bit, but bear with us for a moment. It was a speech that's said to have taken him 3 days to write, and he certainly didn't shirk on the moral opprobrium. As you heard, aside from bemoaning Britain's overly liberal judicial system, he also called Richard Desmond a pornographer. He took delight in detailing again some of Max Mosley's dungeon-based depravity. We'll hear from Dan Tench, a partner at media law firm Allswang, about the ins and outs of the privacy law bit of this in a moment. But first, let's get some reaction to Dacre's diatribe, starting with the now former president of the Society of Editors, Simon Bucks.
The effect of this introduction of this privacy law by the back door is going to have a chilling, or is having already, having a chilling effect on journalism and journalists. And as Paul Dacre said, you know, we are seeing situations where newspapers are being confronted with very expensive legal actions, which are, you know, a really rogue legal actions to some extent. And it's, you know, the impact on newspapers is dramatic. And I think collectively the media should be absolutely fighting against this privacy law by the back door.
Caroline Deal, and I'm chief executive of the Media Trust. Well, I thought he was inspirational. I think it's partly to do with the Obama syndrome, that people are feeling free to talk about morality and right and wrong in a way that even old Gordon Brown hasn't dared to do for a long time. And I think there's going to be a huge shift in the media's own sense of responsibility. And I suspect that Paul will be spearheading that.
I'm Peter Preston, used to edit The Guardian, now write for The Observer. If I were looking at Paul's speech, which I thought was very carefully and very brilliantly written, if it was Strictly Come Dancing, I would have given it an 8. And in terms of where did I slightly start to fall apart, it was over privacy. And at the point where somehow privacy has to be abandoned to help the tabloids survive. It's an interesting argument, but it struck me as a little bit of a stretch, and it'll be worth looking at in a good deal more detail.
There were a few interesting, rather sad old things in there, and I was appalled that a newspaper editor was attacking the Human Rights Act. It shows no understanding of the purpose of the Human Rights Act. He was calling for people to have civil liberties, but then slagging off the Human Rights Act. You know, and it seems to me that, you know, what we as journalists should be doing is fighting for people's civil liberties and human rights. That means one of the things we've got to do is admit when we get things wrong. And what I was intrigued about Dacre was that he made his long speech and left. He didn't take any questions at all. He didn't answer, he didn't give the opportunity to people to say, well, how are you going to justify yourself to the public when you make mistakes?
Mike Jemson, the UK's only professor of media ethics and director of the MediaWise Trust, finishing off that package. Well, sitting very patiently through all of that was the media lawyer, Dan Tench. Thanks for coming in, Dan. What about this idea? Has he got a point that Paul Dacre makes that Justice Edie, one man, has been bringing in a privacy law to Britain through the back door?
He has absolutely no point there whatsoever. It's certainly true that over the last 10 years there's been a very significant development of the law of privacy in this country, but it certainly isn't the work of Mr. Justice David Edie.
But he's the only one that's sitting in judgment on privacy and cases, though, isn't he?
That's not true. There are a number of judges at first instance. For example, Mr. Justice Patton heard the recent privacy case brought by J.K. Rowling about about photographs of her son. And so there are other judges, even at the first instance case, the first court you go to. But the reality is that the law of privacy, as a matter of law, has not been developed at the first instance stage. It's been developed up the judicial hierarchy by the Court of Appeal and, most significantly, by the House of Lords. It's also been developed, as it happens, in Strasbourg, in the European Court of Human Rights. Now, there have been very significant decisions from both those courts which have laid down the landscape of a privacy law in this country. Now, David Eady, as a judge of first instance, has no option but to follow those rulings. Now, you may agree or disagree with those. That is right, but it is grievously unfair to suggest that this is all the work of one man.
What about the point that Paul Dacre raises, that it's unfair that this should be being codified by judges, whether it's one man or several men, and really ought to be the job of our elected representatives in Parliament?
Well, the elected representatives in Parliament passed the Human Rights Act in 1998. That required the courts to develop common law in accordance with the European Convention of Human Rights. The European Convention of Human Rights plainly has a provision safeguarding a right to privacy, and the courts have done no more than they were required to do so. So clearly this was something which was required to do, they were to do by Parliament. However,
But we do have a privacy law in effect now.
Oh, we plainly do have a privacy law. Now, it is true that there is considerable scope for the judges to develop common law, and it wasn't inevitable they were going to end up in this place with a very high degree of privacy protection, although given the prevailing wind from Strasbourg, it was extremely likely. However, it's rather strange for Paul Dacre to oppose this. I mean, we could have a civil code system here that all rights are specifically dictated by by provisions of a law somewhere.
A Bill of Rights, you mean?
Or by what's called a civil code. I mean, it's something they have in the continent. Now, most traditionalists in this country think the notion of the English common law, with the ability of judges to be able to take a flexible approach, is one of the very essential elements of
Paul Dacre wouldn't like that. Yes.
And it's rather strange that Paul Dacre, of all people, seems to be an advocate for the continental system of laws and jurisdiction rather than and turning his back on the notion of a flexible system of judge-made law.
Emily, James, let's bring you both in here. Unimaginable sexual depravity. It's brilliant to hear Paul Dacre say that.
I think he's got a great voice for talking pornography, hasn't he? Yeah. He is, because the enunciation and the cadence is actually completely made for reading bits out of the reader's confessions pages of Razzle, should such a thing still exist.
What about his point that the press has a right to expose the moral shortcomings of people in power? The moral shortcomings.
Well, it depends. You know, the conflation of the moral shortcomings of the people in power, yes, but people in power sometimes have moral shortcomings which actually have no bearing on how they wield power. And I think to sort of put those two things together. Also, Max Mosley is a businessman, actually, and so to the extent of his power is really sort of pretty much limited by the organisation that he runs. He's not a public figure in any way other than
he's a role model to young people who want to be racing drivers.
I was a little bit confused by that. I have to say, you know, the other thing about this, which I do think is very, very bizarre, is that actually somewhere in the speech, which you didn't hear a clip from, he also goes off on a riff about how papers have to be able to write these kinds of salacious stories in order to sell.
Absolutely.
So actually, on the one hand, he's saying, very, very important. Absolutely. On the other hand, he's saying, hang on, saying if we can't have some really sort of, you know, some spank it, some Nazi spanking, we will never shift.
Yeah, the argument is we have to be allowed to muckrake because it sells papers so that occasionally we can do more serious things. I was going to say proper journalism, but of course their journalism is all very proper. But that is the weakest part of his argument. I mean, you can't. It's just a ridiculous thing to say, you know.
I mean, who would we rather have? Do you think Judge Dacre or Judge Eady as our moral guardian?
Dan makes a really good point about actually one of the things that this exposed was either I think Paul Dacre's a very smart guy, was being deliberately provocative by that, or he really has very little understanding about how law is actually made. You don't really want Paul Dacre as your moral guardian, not apart from anything else, because actually the male do things which I think are quite sort of dubious in terms of putting photographers and perhaps, for want of a better word, on people's doorsteps, going through their bins, harassing people about things like their sexuality, which are actually really none of anybody else's business. You know, they're sort of delighted in outing or semi-outing both public and sort of private figures, and you think this is completely beyond the realm of what the decent press should be
doing. And then there's his own website, of course. I mean, I don't know if James, have you seen the Daily website recently?
It's showbiz-tastic, isn't it? I mean, it really is. It is. I mean, it is completely, Scantily Clad women coming out of nightclubs. I mean, it's got nothing to do with the core values of the male as he would see them. So commercially, that's the decision they've made. I mean, so it is, to my mind, complete hypocrisy.
Well, we heard him talk about Dan, the Max Mosley case. From a legal point of view, how significant was the Mosley ruling?
Not very, certainly in terms of...
Because everybody seems to be making it out. It is
an extraordinary thing, certainly for those of us who've been watching the development of privacy law closely over the last few years. The Max Mosley case was perhaps the least significant of a number of cases. It really was applying well-established principles of privacy law, and some of us have been writing about it, have been talking about it for a very long period of time now. And it came as a surprise to us that this wasn't well-known, particularly amongst the media, that effectively we have a privacy law. What was most interesting about it from a matter of law was not the question of privacy and what's an invasion of privacy, but the question of damages, because it was the first time that the question of a recovery of damages had really been looked at in a privacy case. But beyond that, well established, the law is now tried and tested. It's been upheld by the higher courts. In fact, it's been made by the higher courts, and that's that. If I can just raise one other point about the question of the moral guardian. I mean, the real answer is who should be the moral guardian. We don't want a moral guardian. We have a law, a country ruled by law, not by morality. And this is the point about the courts. David Eady has been invited in a number of times to say that there is a public interest in the material, which is a defence to a privacy action. If you've got a public interest in publication, and that public interest can be engaged because the matter is immoral and exposes immorality, and he says, whose morality? I can't impose my morality. The court's going to get itself into a real mess if it starts making moral decisions, because, as I say, the question is whose morality? Some Christians will think homosexuality is immoral. You know, all sorts of people have different views, and perhaps it's the classic single fallacy of the Daily Mail to think that there is one single morality which applies throughout this country.
Do you think that there's going to be pressure on MPs because of this, of what Dacre said, because of the Max Mosley case and all the other cases that have been building up, once and for all, so to speak, set all this down in law?
Well, this may be the opening shot in a campaign to try and get Parliament to swim back against the tide of privacy law, or at least to codify it in legislation. In terms of codifying it, I think there's a real problem, because as soon as you ask people what should be the contents of a privacy law, well, what is it? What is private? What is a justification for an invasion into privacy? And it seems essentially that it has to be developed on a case-by-case basis, and you can only get some sense of the parameters of a privacy law, what constitutes private information, on a case law basis. What would it say? What would a law like that provide?
And it's likely as well, sorry to interrupt, but it would be likely that there would be quite a lot of opposition from the press, wouldn't it, James? And
it was ironic that Dacre's accusing judges of making a privacy law almost ad hoc. I mean, if Parliament was to stand up, as it has considered doing in the past from time to time, and said, right, we're going to have a privacy law, Paul Dacre would be the first person to oppose it, as would every other newspaper prior to, the Murdochs and so on. So
it's unlikely to happen.
Yeah. Well, and in terms of rolling back, obviously Parliament could pass an Act of Parliament saying there is no privacy law and that line should be abandoned. The trouble with that is that would put us at odds with the European Convention, and it would just mean that it would be a succession of litigants going off to Strasbourg and recovering substantial sums in damages, not from the newspapers, but from the British government.
And Paul Dacre certainly wouldn't like that.
He wouldn't like that either.
No, if you've got anything nice to say about the Daily Mail's editor, do leave it, because I feel that we've signed.
for instance, if you're his wife or mum, then
do leave a comment at guardian.co.uk/mediatalk. Thanks very much to Dan Tench from Allswang. So I guess, Emily, Mr. Justice Eady should probably watch his bins.
Yeah, I think Paul Dacre will be kind of trying to tamper with his back door to invade his privacy. And if he likes to be known as Marjorie at the weekends, I think he should watch out.
Yes, well, yes, we'll see what happens. Watch the mail in weeks to come. I'm Matt Wells. This is Media Talk, still to come on this podcast, From Privacy to Public Spectacle. We ask why Martina Navratilova, Danny Bear and that old bloke from Star Trek have signed up for 3 weeks in the Australian jungle. But first, let's whiz around a few of the other media stories of the past 7 days. First of all, Virgin Media are cutting 2,000 jobs, Emily. This is the biggest job cut in the media sector so far. Is it all to pay for Rich and Judy's salary on watch?
I really hope not. Otherwise, those 2,000 people are really on sort of sub minimum wage. Obviously, 2,000 people in Virgin Media. They run call centres, you know, they have sort of service vans, etc. You know, it's a pretty big operation.
They keep people like us on hold.
They keep people like us on hold, but they have put back the Sky channels.
This is very good.
I'm so excited. I don't have to go upstairs now to watch Sky News.
Or into the back room in my
case. It'll be done in the front room.
And obviously, this is a seamless link into the next story, which is that Richard Wolff, formerly of Sky One, just arriving on Virgin Media, he's left to join Dawn Airy's Chorus at Five. James, what do you make of that move?
Well, I don't know Richard Wolff, but didn't he do Stars in Your Eyes? Famously at Edinburgh, so maybe that's set for a comeback.
He's seldom seen without a spangly catsuit, even when the occasion doesn't really require it.
Is that right? No, he's a good sport, I know, but I mean,
what Channel 5 clearly needs is an injection of fun, isn't it? Really?
Yeah, well, I don't know, it's fun. It's fun enough as it is, isn't it?
I think
the Daily Mail will soon be up in arms about Five's content, judging by Dawn Airy's recent programmes.
This personal message to Paul Leather, can I please be sent a copy of Brandon Ross, What the Fuck Was All That About? Because I missed it.
Paul Leather is the head of press.
You don't have to explain that. Our 10 listeners.
Surely you can watch
list.
It on a catch-up service, Emily. Yeah. Surely.
I don't think Channel 5 is on it to catch us. Virgin Media, they need to get on there.
They're well behind the curve, aren't they?
But it said they need to, do you know what they need to do? They need to schedule 30 Rock on Friday nights at 9:30, right from the beginning. Ride the Tina Fey wave.
What do Channel 5 need to do to pull themselves out of the sort of, you know, they're just sort of they feel to me like one of those, you know, other channels down the EPG rather than like proper channel.
They need to buy ITV,
right?
And they might well do. They can't, you know, at the moment, the scale and the budget, you know, they're asking what they need to do is sort of like saying, well, they need to wash their windows with milk and hide under the table and wait for the sort of nuclear apocalypse, because they're of such a scale.
I did get it in the end.
You got it in the end. Actually, they don't quite have the scale, but they do need to make more noise. I mean, I think where Dawn Airy is absolutely right is where she says, you know, we need to kind of project sort of wider and louder than we actually are. And there isn't really anybody doing that in sort of British telly at the moment. They're all a bit cowed.
Yeah, well, a lot of the Channel 5 programmes are very good. I mean, if some of those programmes, if Channel 4 had them, they would market them brilliantly. They'd use their marketing clout to get a lot of press and publicity. Sorry, Paul Leather. You're doing a brilliant job. But, I mean, that's what they need, isn't it? They just need to shout more.
They could take over, as I say, if they dusted off 30 Rock, because they've got sort of the second series of 30 Rock and Californication.
What is 30 Rock? I don't know. What are you talking about?
That impressionist. Who did the Sarah Palin
impression? It is Tina Fey. It's the funniest show on telly ever. And they scheduled it very late on, I think, US 5 or something like that. And subsequently, nobody watched it.
Mm. TV about TV, isn't it? Is that right?
It's TV about TV, which never gets a big audience, but it does get a bit of critical purchase. So if you want your opinion formers to write about Channel 5 or even your showbiz correspondents, then, you know, put something on that actually they'll watch and they think it's funny. And they could do that with Californication, which was very good, and 30 Rock, which they bought. And actually, you think about kind of Channel 4's bought-in comedy, which has not been great. Mm. Of late.
Well, the trouble is this is another thing that gets me really annoyed, is that they're stuck with Desperate Housewives and Ugly Betty, both of which are now rubbish.
They are rubbish. Mm. Well, I keep watching Desperate Housewives just because you
I've given up on that.
Ugly Betty just could never get into. Just not good enough.
The first series I thought was very good.
No, not good enough.
All right. Listen, we heard last week's podcast, we heard from Michael Grade. We heard about his views on the F word. The same debate reached the Commons this week. Here's Labour MP Dennis McShane.
I watched Jamie Oliver reporting from Rotherham. I watched a quiz show. F. Please tell the BBC, please tell Ofcom. You don't hear that in France. You don't hear it in Germany. You don't hear it in America. Why is British broadcasting got to be in the linguistic sewer of our great language?
You don't get that sort of language on this podcast. In the same debate, Culture Secretary Andy Burnham criticised the senior management of the BBC for being too slow to react to the Manuel Gate affair, and then quoted a newspaper survey which suggested that the swearing goes up almost immediately after the 9pm watershed.
It's not obligatory then to use bad language after the watershed. I think he speaks for many people in this country in saying people accept that language used on television programmes does need to reflect the language that is used in this country. But at times, the line has clearly been crossed.
Emily, have you got anything to say about this?
It's bollocks, isn't it?
It is bollocks, yeah.
We made that
too fucking right. He's got a cheek saying late to react to Manuel's. I mean, obviously he's right, but he was reacting how many weeks after it actually sort of
Well, but
it's
not
gone
for the culture secretary.
He is the culture secretary on the Clapham Omnibus, isn't he? It's like, you know, any kind of trivial issue, and Andy Burnham's got a kind of a slightly odd, you know, opinion about
but
it immediately.
But isn't it?
X Factor, Laura White, it's a disgrace. I think this is very good. He's turned Prime Minister's Question Time into a version of TV Burp. Did you see that thing the other night on Emmerdale? Absolutely disgusting. Does that really
he's
happen
proving,
in agriculture?
He's proving his populist credentials, isn't he?
But I mean, I quite like Andy Burnham because, you know, he's got a bit of a personality and he's not a robot.
Likes the wedding present. Used to go to the Hacienda.
Yeah.
Wonder what he got up to.
He doesn't like to talk about it. No. You're right. He's a sparky guy. We like him.
I like him. Yeah.
More TV banter though in the Commons. I think.
I don't know. That was an extract from the culture questions to the culture secretary last week, and it was just astonishing. MP after MP, all, you know, most of whom just a few weeks ago were going on about how brilliant the BBC was for their marvellous Olympics coverage in the last culture minister's question time, now how terrible it is and it must be abolished.
Oh, it's just, you know, it's dangerous dogs, isn't it, for the media? It's just, it's lamentable, really.
Don't talk about Dawn Airy like that.
Media Talk with Matt Wells on guardian.co.uk.
If you've got anything to say on any of these stories, or the ones we've neglected to discuss, leave your thoughts on the blog at guardian.co.uk/mediatalk. Now, The Guardian's TV writer Gareth McLean has joined us. How are you, Gareth? Any message for Paul Dacre? is it printable or is it broadcastable?
Printable. Countdown are still looking for a host.
He could be the host of Countdown.
I'd like him to go on there and the conundrum to come up. Bumfuck. See what happens. See how he sorted that one out.
Yeah, well, I think we're going to have to bleep this week's show. Now, Gareth,
honestly, all these MPs, it's like if there's a passing bandwagon on, they jump. Surprised the wheels haven't fallen off. If the government would like to consult me about the current economic downturn, I am available, since everyone's got an opinion on the telly.
Gareth, it's November, so it means it's I'm a Celebrity time. Have you got jungle fever?
Is it? No, that's a hangover. No, I don't have jungle fever. No, I just find it really hard to get just any kind of remote excitement about that.
Well, you know, but you
really?
Really? No excitement?
Even the possibility of Sulu from Star Trek and Brian Paddock striking up a romance does not fill me with joy.
Danny Bear. I say the man tired of I'm a Celebrity, tired of life, Gareth. It's really upsetting, isn't it? What next?
I'm far too busy growing a moustache and watching Britannia High.
Martina Navratilova, why? I don't understand. Everyone else has got careers that they need to get back on track. I don't understand.
You can just imagine, well, she's not making so much money anymore.
She must be a millionaire.
I think she's made a lot. I think she's made a bit.
One of those. I mean, you know, our agents told her to do this, and it's probably not. Do you know what I mean? And they've maybe not been told this truth of the humiliation and dignity that it
weighs. She'll have been told it's the biggest show in the UK.
Yes.
UK. And I'm on air for like 10 weeks. Fantastic.
You can imagine the production meeting, though, can you? Aging American who has no idea what they're doing. Check. That's the guy from Star Trek.
Right.
Camp Matriarch. Check. If you can't
Ranson buy, and...
Ranson and Paddock.
Right.
And Page 3 Stunner. Check.
Ex-boy band star.
Exactly.
Well, is that the problem, that it's so formulaic? Or do you think that...
I think that is part of it.
Do you think they start out as a formula, Emily, but it can transcend it? I mean, Kerry Katona has done very well out of her appearance, hasn't she?
Mum's gone to Iceland and a few other places. I think it doesn't matter. I think it transcends. I think it is about interpersonal relationships. It's the unravelling of people's personalities on live TV. Well, we never get sick of that, Gareth. Can't we never get sick of it? We like to see it.
I think when you've got personalities of this calibre, I'm not that bothered about them unravelling. Given the quality of the voting of the British public with its love of the underdog, whoever appears not to have any chance of winning will eventually be the winner.
Yeah, that's true. So what I want to know, though, is who's going to be presenting the crap ITV show, ITV2 show afterwards? have you been approached?
I haven't. No, I haven't been approached.
Okay, well, if you want to pick your winner, you can do so at guardian.co.uk/mediatalk. What else has been catching your eye this week, Gareth?
Oh, Chris Moyles.
Chris Moyles is going to... Now, what's this about Chris Moyles?
Will you let me finish a sentence or not?
Okay.
Yes, Chris Moyles will be presenting a celebrity quiz on Channel 4.
Good Lord.
How interesting. And they want public money.
The
only thing he's top-sliced lately is a fish supper.
That's true. But Chris Moyles has always wanted to be on television, hasn't he? And,
yeah.
And Channel 4's Andrew Newman said that he was the biggest star in Britain not to have a television show. Do you think he was just meaning, you know,
by volume? Yes. Imagine watching Chris Moyles on your iPod. You'd probably see, like, just a bit of his belly button and that's all.
So that's Chris Moyles destroyed.
Just go, let's just send good. It to playground, you know, bullying this.
Can I just say, good, on behalf of Nicola Roberts... You're absolutely right.
Exactly. He's a nasty misogynist.
He's a nasty, homophobic, misogynistic bully.
In fact, I wouldn't be surprised if him and Paul Dacre were engaged in some illicit romance.
That's it for this week. My thanks to Emily Bell, to James Robinson and to Gareth. Earlier to Dan Tench, who did us a very good deal on his hourly rate. Media Talk is produced by Ben Green, who we're delighted to welcome back onto the team after 3 months at the Priory. Actually, it was in the United States. Stay strong, Benjamin. I'm Matt Wells. There'll be more Media Talk next week. Goodbye for now.